From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In a recent article for Rolling Stone, the journalist Sabrina Rubin Erdley says the movement for the rights of transgendered people is having its moment right now. Rubin Erdley says at the farthest outpost of this movement, you'll find kids, transgendered youth. This week on our website, Video West, we've posted the story of Eddie Hayward. Eddie was raised in a conservative Mormon family in Utah County. When she was 19, she was finally able to tell her parents she identified as a woman, though born a man. But Eddie had always wondered about her gender, even when she was very, very young. Today in the program, we're working through the questions that Eddie's parents and church leaders and public officials are dealing with. How do you raise transgendered youth? How do you treat them? Where do they fit? Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about transgendered young people. If you're a parent, if you're an educator or a public official, even a church leader, how do you deal with a young person who was born with a birth anatomy that doesn't match their gender identity? In a recent article for Rolling Stone, the journalist Sabrina Rubin Erdley tells the story of Coy Mathis, a young boy from Colorado who identifies as a girl. Coy and his family, or her family, are on the forefront of the trans rights movement, which Erdley says is advancing more swiftly than even its advocates ever imagined. This week on our website, Video West, we've posted a film about Eddie Hayward, a young transgendered woman from Utah County who traveled to Thailand over the summer for sexual reassignment surgery. Eddie's conservative Mormon family has been supportive. Their experience could help us explore this subject today. Eddie and her father will join us later on the program. In the meantime, we invite you to join the conversation. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Sabrina Rubin Erdley is joining us today, an investigative journalist, contributing editor at Rolling Stone. Her article about a girl appeared last month in the magazine. We'll put a link to it on our website. She's joining us today from public radio member station WXPN in Philadelphia. And Sabrina Rubin Erdley, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
I wanted to have you begin, if you would, by telling a little bit about the story at the center of your article about Coy. And I suppose in some way this is kind of the typical story of a transgendered young person and their relationship with their folks. Coy's born a male, but loved frilly things, roughly clothes, lots of sparkly and pink things. And I guess like a lot of parents, Coy's folks figured this was a stage, you know, a phase, kind of harmless, I guess, at first.
That's right. Coy began expressing a preference for anything that was sort of stereotypically girly even before she could speak. When she was like 18 months old, she would show a preference for anything that was sparkly, you know, the princess dress-up clothes. She wanted to play with the dolls, not the matchbox cars. And she had siblings of both genders, so she grew up surrounded by all manner of toys. But she instinctively reached for anything that that she could see, I guess, as being identified as being for girls. And her parents thought, well, you know, this is harmless play, you know, that this is the mind of a toddler whose mind has not yet been touched by the sort of social constructs of masculine and feminine, and that she would work it out in time.
And it's interesting how they kept it private at first, allowed her to dress like that in the privacy of their home. And we should explain, as you do in the article, that they live in this area where you could make a pretty fair assumption that it would be hard for people to take. I mean, this is near five military installations, not far from this big evangelical megachurch. So they wanted it private at first.
That's right. They live near Colorado Springs, which is a very conservative community. And they felt that it was okay for Coy to engage in this kind of behavior in the privacy of their own home. They saw it was totally harmless. But doing it outside the house, you know, letting your son outside in a skirt is a whole other thing. It invites all kinds of questions and scrutiny. And it also really challenged, you know, how far the parents were willing to go with this. Because, you know, while they saw it as being okay inside the house, did they really feel okay enough with it to let their son parade around the streets in a dress? Right. You know, they weren't at that point. This was really a slow progression for them in really accepting how persistent and insistent Coy was that she was actually not a boy but a girl.
Mm. So the family figures at first that and this is interesting. They figure Coy's gay. And you know, they're progressive people, so they're okay with that. But it's interesting. Does this seem to be kind of the de facto category for the uninitiated at first, with understanding this as a person being gay?
I think so. I think that the idea that you have somebody who's gender nonconforming, somebody who, especially for a boy child, biological boy, who's acting effeminately, you sort of the default is that you assume that they're going to be gay, which. Coy's mother told me that it was actually an assumption that she made when Coy was about two, and she felt very uncomfortable. Even though she's a very progressive person and felt fine with the idea of having a gay son, she felt very uncomfortable with the idea that she was entertaining these thoughts about a child who was still in diapers, to talk about a child's sexuality. You think of children really as being a blank slate, and she was very reluctant to put Coy in any kind of box or affix any kind of label to her. But yes, at the time she figured, well, Coy is probably gay. And so they felt kind of well prepared for that. But they did not feel very prepared for what happened next, which was that when Coy became old enough to verbalize, when she turned about three, she started correcting her parents and saying things like, why are you calling me he? And finally, when she was about three and a half, she asked her mother in a very heartbreaking conversation, when am I going to get my girl parts? When am I going to be fixed? And that was when Coy's parents realized that they were dealing with something else altogether.
Mm. You mentioned, I referred to this earlier, that this is in some ways the trans rights moment right now, this movement. And I'm wondering, talk a little bit about that, because you mentioned the psychiatric community, for example, how they have made this sort of transformation, or they've changed the way they categorize trans people. And the trans community thinks this is a very big deal.
Absolutely. This year, the new diagnostic manual for psychiatrists came out, and it was updated to replace its old classifications for trans people, which was called gender identity disorder. They changed the language there to calling it gender dysphoria. And that reflects the psychiatric community's new understanding that having a gender identity that doesn't match your birth anatomy doesn't actually make you mentally ill.
Right.
Only the kind of distress that you might feel as a result is considered a problem. So that diagnostic change was greeted within the trans community as just being a momentous turning point, like as momentous a turning point as when the diagnostic manual declassified homosexuality as a mental illness. You know, and what a huge step forward that had been for the gay community.
So you mentioned that the trans movement, that the final frontier of this movement is the transgender youth part of the story, that the farthest outpost of all of this you point out. And you say in the article that young people are coming out as trans earlier than ever. I wanted you to talk about that and explain why you figure that might be.
Well, that is true. Kids are certainly coming out as trans earlier than ever. Now, that doesn't necessarily indicate that there are more trans people than there were before, only that there seems to be – we're at a moment in time when kids are expressing these behaviors, and there is, instead of parents, you know, reacting negatively towards it, I suppose there's a new movement to be kind of embraced and supported. So in fact, there was a survey of the San Francisco School District that found that over 1% of high school students, 1.6% of high school students identified as transgender. And in fact, 1% of middle school students identified as transgender. And on top of that, there are just a handful of these gender identity clinics in the U.S. that specialize in dealing with these kinds of kids. And they are just absolutely packed. Mm. I mean, they have, you know, these long waiting lists. They have kids coming in internationally for treatment. So, and what that's leading to is that it's leading to really a brand new battleground, which is the public schools, which is ultimately where Coy Mathis's battle led to.
Yeah.
And public schools are starting to think about, even the ones who haven't dealt with transgender children, there are skirmishes that are going on at like sort of the district and county and state levels over transgender rights in public schools. And in fact, 2013 was a huge year in terms of educators issuing guidelines to accommodate trans students. The biggest news of all was that California became the first state to actually pass legislation saying that transgender students can choose whichever bathrooms or locker rooms or sports teams they wish based on their gender identity.
Yeah. You know, this gets us to this new therapeutic approach to all of this that you write about. But before we get to that, what was the old way? What was the way that you would deal with this before? Because you mentioned in the article, it wasn't so long ago that parents were sort of told to kind of tell their kids to conform, that we'll figure this out later, I guess?
The old approach was a conformity-based kind of model.
Yeah.
And if you brought a kid to a counselor, they would encourage you to have the kid dress and act in ways that would conform to their birth gender and to reward them for doing so and to punish them if they stepped outside those boundaries. That is a model which the kind of the new way of thinking, the new camp now calls reparative therapy.
Right. What's the new model then? It's the affirmative model is, I guess, the way they're describing it.
That's right. The affirmative model now is sort of like the forefront of the new therapeutic approach in which children can live as their preferred gender. It's really like this very loving, supportive point of view where the parents are encouraged to follow the children's lead, see what their preferences are, and if their preferences lead them so far, is to let them, you know, if they're a biological boy who wants to be a girl, you know, let them wear a dress, let them, you know, use a girl's name, live as their preferred gender, what's known as social transition. Mm-hmm. And this is it's interesting because, you know, this affirmative model has really found a very warm reception among the very worried parents of trans children who really want to do right by their kids. Mm.
I guess the crucial question is, at what point do you make that social transition or do you address the gender issue? How young? Because you point out in your reporting that most doctors believe, you know, parents shouldn't consider going through with that transition before the age of 10, I think it was.
Yeah, I think that these are the questions that are really being asked right now, and there's no clear answer to it. I mean, you have kids like Coy who, for example, I mean, when she was three or four, once she realized that she was not going to get her girl parts anytime soon and that she had to dress in boy clothes when she had to leave the house, she actually became profoundly depressed and wouldn't leave the house. She would just take to the couch and wrap herself in her pink blankie for days. And for a kid like Coy, I mean, how can you say, you know, wait until you're 10 years old to get some kind of treatment? It was like Coy's parents never intended to raise their son as a daughter, but it was like they just needed – it was like they were taking baby steps the whole way to get there, you know. In order to get Coy to leave the house – they finally just said, fine, wear a skirt outside, you know, wear a hair bow, it's fine, you know. And next thing you know, Coy was wearing, Mary Janes that matched her hair bow. Mm-hmm. And so little by little, they were kind of easing into Coy becoming a girl until they finally came to realize that really the one who was doing the people who were doing the social transitioning, it wasn't really Coy. It was really a process of transition for the parents.
Right.
Coy always knew who she was. Yeah. It was just a question of the parents getting accustomed to it.
I wonder though, it seems like a legitimate question, does it not, to ask what does a kid I mean, this is the question that Catherine Mathis is asking about Coy. She's like, what does he know? He's two. You know, he's too young to have any of that sort of sensibility. So, you know, because you also mentioned that that it can be quite common for a young person who's not transgendered to dress in girls' or boys' clothes counter to their sex. So how do you identify what part of that is in fact a phase and what part of that is an actual clinical diagnosis of related to gender identity?
Yeah, and that's absolutely very challenging. I mean, there's not a lot of good data in terms of how many of these gender nonconforming kids actually grow up to be truly trans. And in fact, a recent study found that 85% of gender nonconforming kids turn out not to be trans.
Yeah.
So, but at the same time, some studies do suggest that extreme nonconformity in early childhood, like kids like Coy or kids who wish for opposite genitals, for example, mm-hmm. would be an example of extreme nonconforming behavior, that can be a very reliable predictor of kind of true transgenderism. And that if the symptoms are persistent and extreme and they surface early, then all those things could be good predictors. But it does, you know, it does raise the question, you're right, of, you know, what does a child know? I know that, you know, one question that was also often asked of me while I was doing the reporting of this story is, or the feedback I would get is, my kid wanted to be, you know, Spider-Man, you know, said, oh, I'm Spider-Man. Well, that didn't really make him Spider-Man. But I think that doesn't really hold in this case because, you know, you might have a kid who wants to be Spider-Man, but 6 months later, most likely he doesn't still want to be Spider-Man.
Right.
And 2 years later, he probably doesn't want to be Spider-Man anymore. He's probably embarrassed by the memory of having wanted to be Spider-Man.
Yeah.
But when you look at these kids, and I met a lot of them over the course of not just Coy, but I went to a conference called the Transgender Health Conference where there were a lot of families, like Coy's families. And you look at these kids and the persistence of their behavior is astounding.
Yeah.
I mean, these kids know who they are. And in fact, somebody asked me over the course of my reporting, well, when did you know that you were a girl?
Mm.
And it's a question I never thought to ask myself. Because, I mean, I guess I always knew. I never thought about it. But I've never had to think about it because it was in line with everybody's expectations of me.
Right. There's this undercurrent here we should mention, of course, and that is the extraordinary rates of bullying and of assaults and of suicide. I mean, this is one of the things that I think makes this issue and figuring out how to deal with it fairly urgent, I guess.
Yes, and I think that that's really driving much of the sort of affirmative model here is that the downside of, say, doing nothing or of doing the opposite, of kind of squelching this behavior, is that the trans community has an incredibly high rate of self-harm, especially trans youth. When they enter adolescence and their bodies start betraying them, they start turning into something that to them is just grotesque. It is a profound kind of unhappiness, and it's a time when all manner of bad things happen to them. Depression, suicide attempts, drug abuse. Very often they experience homelessness, and there they can become the victims of physical or sexual abuse. Trans people have a very high rate of being murdered. So it's just a bad, bad path. So the idea is that if these kids feel loved and supported, no matter what path they choose, they'll be in a healthier place. So the idea really is to get them to kind of survive this period.
Yeah.
And ideally to thrive.
Yeah. Right, because that seems like – I mean, it's one thing, I guess, you mentioned this in the article, and you just were sort of referring to that adolescent – you know, when puberty kicks in, that's when everything seems to change, and it does raise that question. Do you let them just sort of endure, you know, through the – that or do you intervene, you know, medically? Because there are some medical interventions that can delay – puberty. I mean, I guess, how do you feel about that? Or what did you learn about that part of the story?
Well, this is where things get kind of frightening, I guess, even for the most trans positive parent. This is where things get kind of scary for them, because it's one thing to let your biological boy dress as a girl. It's another thing to medically intervene and say, you know, I'm going to assertively put you on this path. You know, nobody wants to make the wrong decision for their child. But there is a medical regimen that can help children through this period of their lives. I mean, the idea is, if they go through this period of their puberty, not only do they have the potential to develop this kind of incredible unhappiness, but also they develop these physical characteristics that can really not be undone. I mean, some of them can be undone surgically, but they're never going to pass, let's say, as their preferred gender. And should they decide, you know, that they truly are trans later in life. And but if there are medical interventions early on, then if they do decide that they're trans, then they can develop bodies that better resemble the gender that they want. So what parents are now doing is putting kids on puberty blockers, first of all, so that they can delay puberty for a little while, and thus extending the period of time where they can make that crucial decision. And I think what's crucial here, too, is that the parents and the clinicians are really watching the kids to make sure that this is something that they really want. This has always got to be, you know, child-driven.
Yeah.
But at the end of this puberty blocker regimen, when the kid is in their early teens, if they still want to move forward with it, then they start receiving cross-sex hormones so that they begin developing secondary sex characteristics that are of their preferred gender.
Sabrina Rubin-Erdley is with us, a contributing editor at Rolling Stone. Go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org, for a link to her feature, About a Girl, it's titled. It appeared in the magazine last month. We also invite you to visit our companion website, videowest.kuer.org is the address, for a new short documentary called Trans Mormon. It's the story of Eddie Hayward and her family. Eddie is a young transgender woman from Orem, Utah. The film was created by her friends at OHO Media. Sabrina Rubin-Erdley, stay with us. We invite you to join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about an emerging movement within the LGBT community, the role of transgender youth. On our website, Video West, you'll find the story of Eddie Hayward, a young transgender woman in Utah County. And the question that Eddie and her parents and educators and public officials are dealing with is, how do you treat or how do you raise kids who behave in ways that don't match the sex they were born with? The journalist Sabrina Rubin-Erdley is joining us as well. We invite you to join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us here in the studio is Eddie Hayward, born in Utah, lives and works in Utah County. This summer, she traveled with her parents to Thailand for sexual reassignment surgery. Eddie has a degree in social work, has been a guest speaker at Brigham Young University and Utah Valley University, talking to classes and groups about her experience. And Eddie, good to see you. Welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And we also have with us Ed Hayward. He's Eddie's father, executive director of a business consulting firm in Orem, Utah. He and his wife Keiko are active members of the LDS Church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And Ed Hayward, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I guess, Eddie, I wanted to start with you and the question that Sabrina Rubin-Erdley was talking about, that question she didn't ever consider – you know, what's her what's her gender? It wasn't something that really occurred to her, but it did for you and really early on in your life.
Well, what's funny about that is I actually, and this is something that I mention a lot, it's not that I found out that I was a girl. It's that I found out that I wasn't a girl. That's kind of where, had I not ever been, you know, challenged, I would have just grown up assuming that I was a girl.
But it seemed off to you? I mean, was there always a sense of that? Could you even articulate it at that young age?
From what I can remember, I just always identified strongly with my mother and sort of just this maternal instinct. And that's kind of where that started.
You know, one of the things that we talked about earlier on the show was that for the Mathis family, at first they figured, oh, Coy is gay. And that was something that you sort of – this was your experience for both of you. Eddie, you first. This is the thing that you pronounced to your parents at some point. Oh, I'm gay.
Yes. It's actually what I – you know, I assumed that for myself. I thought, oh, well, I'm gender nonconforming and very effeminate. I must be gay.
Yeah. So, Ed, how did you react? I mean, and when what was your sense – you must have early on noticed the same things the Mathis family noticed about Coy, you know, the insistence on the frilly things, on the girly things.
You know, it was interesting reading her article because there were so many parallels to what we experienced growing up with Eddie. And I have to say I'm a different person than I was 10 years ago because I was very ignorant about these kinds of things. Living in a conservative community, whether it's an LDS community or any conservative community, a lot of times you're sheltered to the point where you don't have experiences that allow you to understand these things.
Right.
And one of the challenges I think parents have, if they don't have a good understanding about this, is they assume it's a phase. They don't want to encourage it. And that's kind of what I did. So even, you know, though Eddie was telling me from a very young age that she wanted to be a girl. And when she was about 3, she came to me crying, saying, I want to be a girl. And I thought it was a phase. I know she wanted a Barbie doll for Christmas. I gave her a G.I. Joe.
Wow.
Thinking that's close enough, and I don't want to
right.
I don't want to turn her into a transgender. And this was just completely ignorant of me. And I think it's very common of parents to do this. And I don't judge them because that's the way I would still be if I hadn't had the experiences that I've had.
But explain what you mean. That by turn her into, you, a good part of your thinking back then was this is cultural. This is her relationship with us, and then if we can just man it up.
I realize now that if I could go back in time, I would buy her all the Barbie dolls and frilly dresses that she wanted, because I realize now that this wasn't something that she was going to turn into or turn out of. She is who she is, and she's always been who she is.
Yeah.
And I just didn't have the experiences to understand that. And it was very painful for me to go through those experiences and try and change my way of thinking and unlearn some of the opinions that I developed over the years. And in a way it's been really good for me. I mean, it was painful for Eddie to have to go through those experiences as she was trying to come out. And yes, she told us first that she was gay,
right,
which was fine for us because we didn't know anything else, anything that wasn't what we considered the norm, we called gay.
Yeah.
Now I realize gay is a word that incorporates so many different meanings. But at the time, that was enough for us to get started.
Eddie, I don't know if you remember, but your dad has written about the fact that he had this conversation with you where he explained puppies are puppies and kittens are kittens. I guess did you feel desperate about that? Just like that's it. I have no choice. I mean, how do you remember reacting to that?
To the actual story about the dogs and kittens, I think I remember hearing the story and just kind of thinking, oh, okay, whatever. but I do remember feeling maybe not so desperate or desperate in the sense that I just felt like, you know, I didn't necessarily know exactly what was going on and why there was something wrong with me.
Right.
And I don't think that, you know, because my parents didn't want to, you know, really approach the situation too directly, it kind of left me to try and figure things out by myself, which is where, you know, I came to the wrong conclusion that I was either gay.
Yeah.
Because I was doing a lot of this kind of by myself, you know, researching.
Figuring out what is what's right. the deal with me, right? I mean, mm-hmm. yeah. 801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let's take some calls. Krista is joining us in Orem. Krista, welcome.
Hi. Wonderful show today. I just have helped my transgender son transition from being a biological female to becoming a boy, and he's 18. Will be 19 in a few months. He's going to college now. And what I wanted to say is to kind of echo what Eddie's father just said, and that is my impression and my experience, you know, living through this with our son, is that the decision of whether a child is transgender or not, or what to do or what not to do, that decision does not lie with the parents. In my experience, that decision lies with the child, and they're all very different. And I think to not help and not intervene based on a child's needs is really taking a huge risk. And in my case, had we not tried to help my son, I am convinced actually that we would have lost him to either he would have run away from home, or actually he was going to kill himself. So my perception of the whole situation is that the kids know, they know when something is wrong, and they get incredibly desperate. It's the darkest emotion I've ever seen, this gender dysphoria. And amazingly, I mean, when they do transition, they become, and I mean, my son is the happiest person you can imagine now.
Krista, glad you called.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
You want to react to that, Eddie, what you're hearing from her?
I have to agree. I feel like a lot of the times parents feel the responsibility to make these decisions or to help their child make these decisions. And I feel like, you know, it's our soul, it's our body. While we may not have a great understanding of what's going on at the time, I feel like we're closer to having an understanding and having loving and supportive parents who are just kind of willing to take it at our pace is really the best way to support us through this confusing time.
I want to come back to Sabrina Rubin early, because she says something in her article that I wanted you to talk about, which is that the support from home is so crucial, particularly, you say in your article, at an early age. Because if you wait until later, all this kind of damage can be done.
That's right. You know, a lot of these kids, there was a study done that found that much of the trauma that was inflicted, so the psychological trauma that was inflicted on these transgender kids, was actually emotional trauma that was sustained at home from the messages that they were getting from their loved ones. I think that getting that love and support, the idea that we'll love you no matter what, is so crucial, I mean, to all kids. But particularly for kids who are in this incredibly fraught situation where they themselves are actually very confused. They're getting these messages from within about who they are, but they're getting these very different social messages about who they should be. Mm. And so the idea that they need to come from a place where there's just a foundation of, you know, no matter how this turns out, you know, you're still our child and we will still love and support you. I think you really can't overstate how important that is.
Ed, when did you realize that?
Well, it's kind of painful for me to remember some of the things that I said to Eddie as she was growing up, and I assumed she was a boy. And
You said you wanted to fix her at some point.
I think there's a cycle that you go through, and I'm not a professional like Sabrina and Eddie that have studied these things in detail. I know just from my own experiences, but my wife and I both went through a cycle, and the first stage of the cycle was we wanted to fix Eddie. We thought, okay, no, you're not. And yeah. You're just confused, and we will fix you. And of course, that we soon realized that that wasn't the situation. And eventually we reached a stage in the cycle where we said, you know what, this is okay. And I think for Keiko and I, that took probably about 3 months. After Eddie came and told us, you know, that she was transgender, that she was a woman trapped in a man's body, it probably took us about 3 months. I think we loved and accepted her all along.
Right.
We just didn't understand.
What was the turning point? What was the moment when you finally gave in?
I think we spent a lot of time on our knees praying.
Yeah.
And And I'm a very faithful member of the LDS Church.
Yeah.
So I spend a lot of time counseling with my leaders and trying to understand. And I was lucky I had a stake president and a bishop that were very understanding and were trying really hard to help me to work things through. But I think it was just a matter of one evening I got up off my knees from praying, and I just had a feeling like, I'm sorry, I get a little emotional.
Of course.
I had a feeling that I knew that God loved Eddie even more than I did, and that everything was going to be okay. And then I think that was helped me to kind of move on to that final stage of saying, okay, everything's going to be okay, so let's just figure out how we move forward. And but all through the process, Keiko and I talked, and we wanted to make sure Eddie always knew that it didn't matter to us. We loved her, whether she was our son or our daughter. That didn't matter. And it was really just a matter now of figuring out how do we help her through the process. At first, she told me she didn't plan on doing the SRS, the sexual reassignment surgery, but I think she just said that because she thought that's what I wanted to hear.
Yeah.
And I kind of knew that. And so then we made the decision that if she was going to go through the SRS, that we wanted to support her even financially, and that it's pretty expensive, because I wanted to make sure she knew that we accepted her and that we loved her. And you know, I say something in the little video clip that you have, the documentary that you posted. It's not really a video clip, but the documentary that you posted, I say something in there that I think is really important for parents to understand and for people that haven't gone through the experiences that I've gone through to better understand. I occasionally have people come up to me and we're talking about the eternal ramifications, you know, of having SRS. And they often assume...
Explain what you mean by eternal ramifications. The ramifications for you, the way your church believes the world works.
Yeah, we believe that we'll be resurrected, and that we'll be resurrected as a gender. You know, we're not going to be, you know, resurrected as some cloud that doesn't have a gender.
Yeah.
And they will always make the assumption that I believe that Eddie's going to be resurrected as a man, because she was born as a man. And
so God will fix this thing that happened down here.
Yes. And, and frankly, 10 years ago, I would have believed the same thing.
Yeah.
But I found a way to explain this to him that's really true. And I try and share that when I can. And that is, if in the next life, Eddie and I both die and we both get resurrected, and I have some young man walk up to me and said, "Dad, it's me. I got resurrected and I'm a man." And I'm okay with that. I don't know that I would be okay with that. Because I have a daughter. That I love. And I would be looking for her. And I would say, who is this strange man that maybe slightly resembles my daughter, but I don't know him. And where is my daughter? And so I don't find that comforting the way people might think I would. And I think most transgender parents who have a similar belief that as I have, as far as, you know, resurrection and things, I think they're going to react the same way. Eddie is my daughter that I love, and I want to be with her.
Ted Hayward, Eddie's father, executive director of a business consulting firm in Orem. Eddie Hayward also with us. Sabrina Rubin-Erdley, contributing editor at Rolling Stone, also with us. There's a link to her article in Rolling Stone about a girl, it's called. And for a link to our Video West documentary, go to videowest.kuer.org. We'll take more of your calls when we get back from a break. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about transgendered young people. There's a video on our new website, Video West, that tells the story of Eddie Hayward. She's joining us here in studio along with her father, Ed Hayward. We also have with us Sabrina Rubin-Erdley, contributing editor at Rolling Stone. There's a link to her article on our website. It's a piece called About a Girl, which appeared in last month's magazine that deals with this. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's go to the phones. Jane is with us from Utah County. Jane, welcome.
Hi. I'm a cross-dresser, member of the Mormon Church, and a member of Triad, which is a national sport with cross-dressers. I was working as the president for the last year of the local chapter. The issue I ran into when people were looking for support was they would immediately back down because of fear of losing their temple recommend. I think the Mormon Church needs to reach out to people so they know they can get the support they need, because it's a very dark place when you feel all alone. And I just want to say I admire the Hayward family and all of what they have done and what they're doing towards the community. I think that's fabulous.
Well, Ed Hayward, let's talk about that, and Eddie too. Ed, you talk about going to the church handbook of instructions, which, for those who don't know, it's kind of the rule book in some ways, right? For and you wanted to know what Eddie's situation would be if she were to go and get a sex change operation and then get married. I mean, I guess you're trying to figure out how is it going to work for my daughter in the scheme of sort of my Mormon worldview. What did you find out?
Well, one of the things that I think is important to understand, and that is I've never taken a stance where I tried to counsel the church on how they should do things. That's not the approach I would ever take. Instead, I try to understand, and in my opinion, the church leaders are trying hard to understand these things, but a lot of them are like I was 10 years ago. They're trying to understand it without having a lot of experiences. And I don't want them to all have to have a son or a daughter that transitions in order for them to understand. And so I think they're reaching out to people like me that have those experiences and talking to us. But then they're the ones that make the decision on the church. They're the ones that receive revelation for the church. I was seeking for revelation that had already been received, regarding these things, and there really isn't a lot. And so I actually asked my stake president, who is the local leader over a number of congregations, I asked him if he would go ahead and call Salt Lake and talk to the brethren about it. I had some questions, and he said, yeah, these things could be interpreted different ways, and he said, I need to get clarification. And the response that I got back was, you have all of the revelation that we have on this so far, and we don't really have anything more that we can give you, which I didn't take as a cop-out or anything, and I don't think it was meant that way. I think they were giving me an honest answer. And
which is they're not sure. We don't know what to do necessarily.
There were some questions that I asked that were pretty deep questions that they didn't have revelation on, and they didn't want to interject their own opinion. And so they were simply saying, we haven't received any revelation on that.
Eddie, how are you thinking about all of this? Born and raised LDS, so you have a kind of spiritual perspective on the world based on your Mormonism. But then there's this part of you that there's this, the sexual core and your spiritual core in some ways. How do you manage both of them?
Well, I've done a lot of kind of personal, like, soul searching, as well as I've been talking to our bishop. And I think that the thing that I stick to the most is that we believe that we come here to Earth and that things are not perfect down here, and that we're here to go through a lot of different trials. And while we go through these trials, that we're also supposed to sort of love and support each other and work together. And so I feel like, there are other, sexually, like, biologically confusing, you could be intersexed, you could be born without genitalia. There are all these variations, and trying to nitpick over the details and figure out, what is God going to do, or what is the church stance on these things, I feel like we're just going to get confused. There are just so many small variations to try to figure out. So I just focus on, what I need to do to get through life and to help me be a good person. And I feel like the sex change was a necessary part for me to be able to be happy with myself and to then be able to go out and just help people and be a good person.
But you don't seem resentful.
I don't think that's productive.
It's possible, though. Let's admit it's possible that you may be excommunicated for having had a sex change operation, right?
Yes. Well, we actually talked about this with my bishop, and there are a couple different courses that we, you know, went over. And the sex change operation in itself was not grounds.
Really?
For excommunication, as I was talking with my bishop, and of course, you know, this is kind of based on my case.
Yeah.
However, if I want to have my church records reflect my sex now that I've had this operation, I would have to be excommunicated and rebaptized.
Wow.
In order to be able to change those records. It's not like, you know, a passport where you just turn in some documents and then they say, okay, we changed it over to female. You know, this
but they would rebaptize you as a female?
Yes.
Huh.
And so I think...
Gosh, I think that's interesting. I mean, because that at least reflects some acceptance of now. I mean, but it also reflects a punishment that you have to go through. So that's kind of strange.
Well, speaking with my bishop and also just kind of researching and looking at what is excommunication in our faith, it seems more like a step that has to be taken, a step to help us.
And whether you accept it or not, you're going to give them a break, it sounds like. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Go ahead, Ed.
Yeah, I just want to make sure. We are not authorized to speak on church doctrine, so we really aren't. Like Eddie said, she's talking about her situation, and that's what she's saying. And I don't think that it is the church stance that someone that has, you know, transgendered and completed the process with SRS that there's a church policy that they can get rebaptized as that gender. This is just something that we're exploring to see if that's a possibility. And right now they're saying that the way things work, they wouldn't just be able to go into the computer system and change that record, that they would have to be – that record would have to be deleted. They have to create a new record. Whether or not that will always be that way, I don't know. And I'm not sure it's as much of a church policy as maybe a database policy. Yeah. I'm not sure.
Sabrina Rubin, early want to bring you back in on this because one, the dynamics in your article, of course, is playing out in a religious environment, not a Mormon one, but an evangelical one in Colorado Springs. What do you make of the religious dynamic and how that's playing a role in this story?
Well, the conservative right, the religious right, is completely against transgenderism. They oppose, you know, LGBT rights in general. Transgenderism in particular, they find particularly offensive. I talked to Focus on the Family, which has really been at the forefront of kind of trying to combat LGBT rights. And I spoke with their gender issues analyst, whose name is Jeff Johnston. And he explained to me that that to them, LGBT people, but transgender people in particular, to them, this is a manifestation of original sin. And they see it as imperative that transgender people get their true genders sorted out. And it's further their opinion that any inner conflict that kids have, all of the depression and suicidal ideation and so forth that they experience as they grow up is actually not because of all the conflict over being trans, but in fact it's because they feel that they're suppressing their true biological gender. And so they see it as their mission to bring these people back into the fold and to have them conform to their biological gender.
Yeah.
Much like when I spoke with Jeff Johnston, we spoke at length about how Jeff is actually, he considers himself an ex-gay. And he told me at great length about how he was able to conquer his own homosexual urges through many years of therapy. And by the same token, he feels that transgender people can overcome their, you know, sort of unholy urges and become, you know, this kind of conforming thing that, you know, that everybody can agree is should be the norm.
Yeah.
And as I spoke to him, I really came to understand that their basis for their worldview, you know, they say that it's very – that's scripturally based. But in speaking to Jeff, I understood that there was a real personal element to it, that he was speaking from a place of great personal suffering and pain, you know, and that really insidious pain of self-loathing. Which actually leads me to say, you know, Eddie, you know, you're very lucky to be in the situation that you are, to have such understanding parents, and it's really very unusual because, you know, despite this new affirmative therapeutic approach, really the norm is for trans kids to be rejected by their parents and by their communities. So you're really in a very privileged minority, and I'm really very happy for you.
Thank you.
I want to say, and because I get a sense Ed's a little nervous about what Eddie has been saying about Mormonism. They're not speaking in any other sort of official capacity through the Mormon Church, and there's probably a sense of what they're not sure what's going to happen. I don't want you to feel nervous about that, Ed. I mean, I think it's pretty clear Eddie was speaking on her own, and you don't know what's going to happen. So,
yeah, thanks for that clarification. I was just a little nervous,
I get it.
I did put my little disclaimer in there, so I feel
you did.
Good now.
You did. So. I just want to say this finally. We don't have a lot of time left, and I'll let Eddie and Ed, you take this finally. I guess in the end, Eddie, it's about love, right? I mean, in the end, that's mm-hmm. the thing. If you can't figure out all this stuff, that's one good fallback.
I think love, and if you can't have love, then at least have respect for, you know, all of these people living on this giant planet.
Ed, final word.
Yeah, I think it is about love. And in the New Testament, when Jesus is asked about the two most important commandments, they both had to do with love. And I think, you know, it's easy to love somebody that agrees with you and is just like you. And I think that's the reason why God created us with differences, different races, different religions, and different orientations, so that we can learn to love each other. And that's really the thing that really counts.
It's Ed Hayward. Eddie Hayward also joined us. And thank you both very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Sabrina Rubin-Erdley is a contributing editor at Rolling Stone. Go to our website for a link to her feature About a Girl, which appeared in the magazine last month. Sabrina Rubin-Erdley, thanks to you very much.
Thank you.
And, of course, we go to our website, videowest.kuer.org, for the short documentary called Trans Mormon. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Taylor Almond, to Anna Sprouse. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.